Not long after his meeting with Wallace, Finn took the Paragon Stuart Lennox drinking to the Sangreal Bar. Finn had spent a lot of time with the young Paragon from Viramond, all but adopting him as his student, partner, and protege. They were friends, inasmuch as Finn had friends. Certainly the young Stuart hero-worshipped the older, legendary Durandal. So they sat close together at one of the best tables, drinking a murky blue wine that Stuart could never have afforded on his own, and the young man listened awestruck as Finn recounted old stories of his famous exploits as Logris's Paragon. Finn carefully avoided any of his more current exploits. He didn't think the boy was quite ready for that just yet. Stuart Lennox was big and muscular, with a stern, humorless face under a thick mop of curly red hair. A sprinkling of freckles across his nose and cheeks made him look even younger than he was. But he wore his Paragon's armor well and proudly, and he had, after all, been trained by the same man who trained Lewis Deathstalker. Finn constantly reminded himself not to underestimate the young Lennox. He was potentially a very dangerous man, which was why Finn had invested so much time in turning him. The bar was getting rowdy. The Sangreal used to be a cop bar, patronized almost exclusively by security personnel from the House of Parliament just up the road, a quiet and civilized place for the serious drinker. But that was before the Paragons discovered it. The Sangreal's owner hadn't objected. The money had been good, and you couldn't buy publicity like that. Everyone would want to drink in a bar that Paragons had patronized. Unfortunately, this new breed of Paragons, who'd returned unsuccessful from their great quest, were very different from those who'd set out so confidently and so joyfully. These Paragons had made the bar their own, and now no one else dared to come in anymore. The Paragons spent their money freely enough, but they did like to party hard. They drank everything there was to drink, openly ingested every drug under the sun, and had sex with each other right there on the tabletops, or with groupies they treated as casually as themselves. There was gambling and fighting every night, and sometimes they played games. Nasty games. Stuart was shocked the first time Finn brought him to the Sangreal. Finn had to stop him from trying to arrest half the Paragons on sight. But Finn hauled him over to a table by brute force, sat him down, and explained that people in high-pressure jobs, weighed down by duties and responsibilities in their public life, needed to relax more than ordinary people, and so were allowed more than ordinary latitude in the pastimes and pleasures they pursued when off-duty. And since it was Finn Durandal saying it, it must be true. Stuart watched the Paragons at their play, and while he never joined in, he slowly lost the ability to be shocked.
I don't think he ever quite got the stain, Al.
So Finn and Stuart were drinking together, talking and laughing, as Finn systematically and quite deliberately enchanted and seduced the young Paragon. Not that he cared a damn about the boy, but he could be a useful tool, if not an ally, and perhaps even a weapon that could be used against Lewis, should he ever be foolish enough to return to Logris. It was an easy enough thing to turn the boy's hero worship into something else. Stuart was young and inexperienced in the ways of the world, and still delightedly innocent in oh so many ways. Day by day, Finn made Stuart into one of his creatures, and set the boy's heart against Lewis Deathstalker. It wasn't difficult at all. They were getting along really well, giggling together over their wine like great chums, when the Paragon Emma Steele made one of her grand entrances. The bouncer tried to block her way.
Here now! You can't do
She struck a pose, hands on hips, and glared disdainfully about her. She was tall and willowy, though her bare arms were heavy with muscle. Her skin was a rich coffee color, and she wore her jet black hair pulled straight back into a tight bun on the back of her head. Striking rather than conventionally pretty, she could still take your breath away, in more ways than one. Emma Steele had been Mistworld's Paragon, greatest fighter of the old rebel planet, and generally considered the most dangerous person on Logris, in or out of the arena. She was the law on Logris. The other Paragons stopped their playing and abandoned their drinks and their drugs and their groupies to rise silently to their feet and stare at Emma Steele. Everyone's hand was near a weapon. No one moved. Emma sneered at them all and stalked across the room, heading straight for Finn and Stuart's table. The other Paragon stood very still, watching her silently with cold, vicious eyes. Even the drunk and drugged-out groupies had enough sense to keep their mouths shut for once. Emma ignored them all with magnificent disdain and crashed to a halt at Finn and Stuart's table. The young Lennox gaped openly at her. If there was one other person in the Parade of the Endless he adored as much as Finn Durandal, it would have to be the almost equally legendary Emma Steele.
What the hell are you doing in a place like this, Lennox, with a man like him? You can't trust a word the Durandal says. Believe me, I have reason to know this.
Stuart flushed angrily. He was already a little drunk and made an effort to speak clearly.
I think I'm quite capable of choosing my own friends. And I don't think you ought to talk like that about Finn. He's Imperial Champion, and the greatest Paragon we've ever had.
I thought that once.
Emma looked coldly at Finn.
He was my hero, and then I met him. And now there's just me to patrol the whole of Logris because the mighty Imperial Champion can't be bothered anymore.
Oh, I have other duties now. New responsibilities. I can't be everywhere at once. And you're doing such a fine job, Emma. Hardly ever out of the news. I hope you've got someone experienced handling your merchandising.
I've never given a damn for any of that shit, and you know it. I care about the job, because someone has to. Lennox, listen to me. Learn from my mistakes. The Durandal isn't the legend he was, if he ever really was.
One of the carousing Paragons suddenly threw away his drink and came charging straight at her, sword in hand.
I'll do you, you bitch!
Emma spun around, her sword leaping into her hand, and met him head on.
The quality of Paragons has really gone downhill recently. I suppose that's what happens when you pal around with the Durandal.
She looked unhurriedly about her, her free hand hovering over the disruptor on her hip. The other Paragons stared flatly back, their faces cold and dangerous, but none of them moved.
Well, it seems I've outstayed my welcome. Lennox, you know where to find me if you need me. Don't leave it too late.
She backed out of the Sangreal, not taking her eyes off the other Paragons, not hurrying, but not hanging about either. The Paragons waited until they were sure she was gone. Stuart looked at Finn, shocked almost sober again by the unexpected confrontation.
What the hell was that all about?
Finn refilled Stuart's glass.
Women. She's just jealous that I've got a new partner. She wanted the position, but she was never worthy of it. Not like you, my dear.
Finn plied the young man with drink, flattered his ego, cuddled and kissed him, and none of it meant anything to Finn. Boys and girls, girls and boys. None of that had ever meant much to him. He took his pleasures as they came, and none of it ever touched him where he lived. In his life, there'd only ever been him. But it amused him to corrupt the idealistic young man and turn him into a weapon that could be thrown at Lewis, most of all because Finn knew how much it would hurt Lewis. As a useful side project, Finn also quietly pried information out of Stuart about Viramond's planetary defenses, just in case he found it necessary to use the transmutation engines on Viramond, after all. Finn believed in covering all the angles. Emma Steele rode her gravity sled high above the bustling streets of the Parade of the Endless. It was the only place she felt safe anymore, high enough in the sky that the madness and the corruption couldn't reach her. Sometimes it seemed that she was the only sane person left in Logris, and she was hanging on only by her fingertips. Other air traffic saw her scowling face and gave her plenty of room. Emma didn't even notice, lost in her own thoughts. She was all on her own these days. Finn left all the work to her, and none of the other Paragons she'd approached would help her, even though they showed no signs of returning to their own worlds. They refused to talk to her, even the few she'd thought of as friends. And the peacekeepers were reluctant to back her up, for fear of being caught in the middle of a Paragon quarrel. So now only one Paragon patrolled Logris, and that was Emma Steele. Sensing her isolation, the criminal element had declared open war on her, and placed an unofficial bounty of 500,000 credits on her head. It hadn't done them any good. Emma took on everyone and everything they could throw at her, and never even looked like losing. She had been raised and trained on Mistworld, that most dangerous and barbaric of worlds, and compared to the everyday menaces she'd faced there, Logris's lawbreakers were just talented amateurs. Her continuing triumphs in the face of overwhelming odds captured the interest of the news media and the public. They needed someone to admire, someone who clearly had no interest in extreme politics or religion, someone not tainted by the current era of corruption and betrayal. And they took Emma Steele to their fickle hearts. To her credit, Emma didn't give a damn. Mostly. She glanced at the watch face embedded in her wrist.
Oh, shit.
She was going to be late for her appointment. She'd reluctantly agreed to allow a reporter to tag along with her for one shift, to show people how much pressure she was under without the Durandal's help. Normally, Emma had no time for reporters, except to kick them when they got in the way at crime scenes, but she needed some way to get her views on Finn to the public. So, for today's shift, she was to be accompanied by one Nina Malapert of Channel 739. All the news as it happens, up close and personal. Not the channel or the reporter Emma would have preferred, but it had been almost impossible to find a journalist willing to put her own ass on the line. Most worked only through their remotes these days, sending their cameras into dangerous areas while they stayed safely in their offices. Said it helped to give them distance from a story. Emma wasn't having any of that. She wanted a reporter right there with her, transmitting live, so they couldn't edit or cut out any controversial material. And the only person to volunteer had been Nina Malapert. The reporter was where she said she'd be, her camera bobbing over her shoulder.
I'm right here, Emma.
She smiled and waved brightly to Emma as the Paragon descended on her gravity sled into the quiet side street they'd agreed on. Nina was a bright young thing, with an open, happy face and a towering pink mohawk. She was wearing a clutter of pastel-colored silks and carrying a large leather shoulder bag decorated with images of pretty flowers. She wore far too much makeup on her somewhat pointed face and had on entirely unsuitable shoes. Emma looked at her for a long time.
You do realize we're going into the rookery today, into the most dangerous and evil part of the city.
Oh, yeah! Absolutely looking forward to it, darling. Don't worry, I got all my gear. Whatever happens, we won't miss a thing. Oh, this is really terribly exciting. Now tell me, before we start, is it true you're a vegetarian?
Yes.
An exclusive!
Nina did a little dance of celebration right there on the spot, punching the air with one fist.
Get on the sled behind me.
Nina hugged Emma tightly around the waist as they flew over increasingly narrow streets, heading into the center of the city and the criminal underworld of the rookery. Nina let her chin rest on Emma's shoulder.
I'm really so glad you chose me for this gig, Emma. Honestly, darling, the competition was... Well, everyone else was very busy. But even so... Oh, I just know we're going to get along famously. I've read all the files we have on you. Well, not all of them, obviously, because there's an awful lot of them. But I skimmed the pricey of most of them. Ooh, we really are frightfully high up, aren't we? I don't normally get to do the crime stuff, you know. Mostly I do gossip. Who's been seen dining with who at which new night spot, who's dumping who, that sort of thing. I was the one who proved Treasure McKenzie is allergic to cats, even though she swore she wasn't. Of course she hasn't talked to me ever since I thrust that cat in her face at a premiere, but then she wasn't talking to me anyway, the snotty co. And sometimes I do the horoscopes when there's no one else left in the office. Oh, but this is the real thing, real reporting. No more gossip for me. I'm going to be a genuine journalist at last. Mummy will be so pleased. Why did you choose me, Emma?
Because you were the only one dumb enough to agree to accompany me into the rookery. And more, it's seeming like a really bad idea. Now keep the noise down and pay attention. Is your camera running?
Oh yes, Emma. Has been ever since you showed up. We are totally live, as you requested.
Well, we've just entered a part of the city that doesn't officially exist. This is where most of the crime that happens in this city is plotted and financed. This is where the really wild animals are. So stay close to me, do what I say when I say it, and for God's sake, don't try to interview anyone. They don't take kindly to being asked questions around here.
So how do you find out things?
Mostly I'll beat it out of them. Now, one of my more reliable snitches got a message to me about a meeting between one of the main agent provocateurs and his secret patron. The agent is apparently threatening to go public over their dealings unless he gets more money. The patron doesn't normally come here in person anymore, so this could be our one chance to nail him. And if it turns out to be who I think it is, you are in for the exclusive of your life.
Emma wasn't ready to mention the Durandal's name yet. Not till she'd caught him in the act. But if he was stupid enough to meet with one of his creatures personally, then live coverage of the two together in the heart of the infamous rookery should finally be enough to cast serious doubt on his goody-goody image. The problem was, she had to get solid evidence against Finn, or it wouldn't stick. Just meeting an agent provocateur wasn't enough. He might still talk his way out of that. She needed coverage of the two of them discussing what they'd planned and done together, whatever that might have been.
Oh.
Maybe she'd get really lucky and the Durandal would implicate himself and then gun down the agent to silence him. Let Finn talk his way out of cold-blooded murder, broadcast live.
Oh, do you mind if I ask you a few more questions? Just till we get there. I mean, there's still so much that people don't know about you, Emma. Like, do you have a steady boyfriend? What's your favorite recipe? Do you have any special makeup tips you'd like to share with our viewers? You are a fashion icon after all, even if it is a rather severe look. What is it like being a woman and a paragon? What do you do for fun?
Luckily, they reached the designated meeting place before Emma decided that she really had to kill Mina. Emma glided the gravity sled down into a shadowy square leading off from a particularly squalid and underlit street. It was all very quiet, with no one about, both of which were highly suspicious. There was always something going on in the rookery, day or night. Emma stepped down from the hovering sled and glared about her. She'd already checked the overlooking windows and rooftops for snipers on the way down, but it didn't hurt to check again. There was nothing obvious to be seen, but the whole situation felt wrong. Nina stepped gingerly down from the sled. Her foot landed in something wet and unpleasant.
Ah! Ooh! Oh, God, darling! This is disgusting! This whole neighborhood needs a good fumigating with a flamethrower. I just know I'm going to catch something I'm going to have a hard time explaining to my doctor. Honestly, it smells like something died here. Very recently. Though admittedly, I have paid absolutely extortionate cover charges to get into supposedly fashionable clubs that smelled even worse. But at least they had a bar. Ooh. Is that supposed to move like that?
Hush!
Emma had come deeper into the rookery than she normally liked, now that she could no longer depend on Peacekeeper backup. But the snitch's tale had been just too tempting. Even if the Durandal didn't turn up, the agent provocateur would have to know all kinds of useful things, which she was sure he could be persuaded to talk about. Though she might have to do the persuading discreetly off camera. There had been mention of Brett Random and Rose Constantine and the things they'd done for Finn before they abandoned him to follow the Deathstalker. What could the Durandal be up to, that two such hardened scumbags had run away from it? Emma was close to answers now. She could feel it. She also felt very much that she'd just walked into a trap, even if she couldn't see it yet.
Where exactly are we supposed to meet this informer of yours? Tell me it's somewhere where they've at least heard of the basic rules of hygiene.
We are going to Mother Molly's kitchen, where they probably couldn't even spell hygiene. I hope you've had all your shots. Stick close to me, don't smile at anyone, and above all, avoid the bar snacks, especially the long pig munchies.
Emma led the way across the deserted square, checking every shadow and opening for unfriendly eyes. But everything was unnaturally still and quiet. Not even a stray dog rooting in the piled-up garbage. Emma strode along confidently, her head held high. There had to be observers around somewhere, and it wouldn't do to let them think they could get to her. Nina scurried along beside her, peering about wide-eyed, like a tourist. The entrance to Mother Molly's kitchen was literally a hole in the wall, with a door propped against it. There was no sign above the door, and no doorman either. If there had been, he'd have been outside throwing people in. Emma grabbed the door and muscled it to one side, revealing a gloomy interior full of several kinds of interesting smoke. Nina took one sniff of the various aromas that drifted out.
No.
She still followed Emma in.
Remember, Nina? Exclusive Exclusive.
The floating camera bobbed uneasily over her shoulder. Inside the drinking den, it was dark and crowded and very quiet. An anticipatory sort of quiet. The 20 or so customers were leaning against the walls, smiling unpleasantly. They were all heavily armed. Set on a card table in the middle of the room was the severed head of Emma's snitch. From the lack of blood, he'd clearly been dead for some time.
I'm assuming that isn't a good sign.
Emma ignored her, raking the room with her best intimidating stare.
So, a trap and an ambush. 20-1 odds. Am I supposed to be impressed? I'm Emma Steele from Mistworld. Right, you're all under arrest for being criminally stupid in a built-up area. Drop your weapons and I'll take you in alive.
No one moved. The Durandal had clearly found some real hard cases to send against her this time. Trained killers. Emma did her best to radiate confidence. She just might have bitten off more than she could chew, but she couldn't let them believe that, or the fight would be over before it even started. At least they couldn't use disruptors in such a confined space, for fear of hitting each other. So, just 20 experienced swordsmen against one. Not good. Not impossible, but definitely not good. Emma gave them her best disturbing stare.
All right, gentlemen. Let's dance. Nina, stay in the doorway. You don't want to get blood on your clothes. Oh, hell with that, darling.
Seven of the swordsmen and half the wall behind them disappeared in a moment. Emma shook her head to clear it and looked behind her. Nina was holding the biggest and nastiest handgun Emma had ever seen. Nina smiled brightly.
Well, really? You didn't think I'd come into the rookery unarmed, did you, darling? My great-uncle Flynn picked this up during the Great Rebellion. He was in the news business too, and he always believed in being prepared. Shall I shoot some more of them?
The would-be ambushers were already disappearing through the great hole in the wall and fighting each other to get out first. They weren't being paid enough to face guns like that. Emma could have grabbed the last few, but she didn't see the point. They wouldn't know anything. Finn undoubtedly hired them through a series of cutouts. She turned to Nina, who was slipping her oversized gun back into her shoulder bag, and smiled at her for the first time.
Nina, how would you like exclusive rights to follow me around on patrol day to day?
Oh, gosh, really? A whole series with my own name on it? I could write my own ticket. What's the catch?
Well, the catch is you'll probably get killed hanging around with me. But if you're game, I promise you exclusives like no one else has ever seen.
We're going to be partners? Comrades in arms? Best chums?
Nina grabbed Emma in a fierce bear hug.
Oh, Mummy is going to be so proud!
The honorable member is patently mistaken.
In the House of Parliament, King Douglas sat slumped on his throne, not really listening to the lackluster debates on the floor. No one noticed his lack of interest or involvement, or if they did, no one cared. The speaker had been bypassed, made irrelevant, and everyone knew it. But behind his disinterested facade, Douglas was doing some hard thinking. He was quietly plotting how best to wrest his power back from those who'd usurped it. He couldn't do much on his own, which meant he needed allies. His first thought had been to turn to his old comrades, the Paragons, but most of them were still scattered across the Empire on their great quest. And the few who had returned were different, altered, strange. They showed no interest in taking up their old duties, and their general conduct was appalling. What had happened to them, alone out there in the dark? Douglas had to wonder if their failure to find the Blessed Owen had broken their spirit in some way. There weren't many MPs left he felt like trusting. The Espers had retired to the floating city of New Hope and battened down the hatches, and Shub went its own way, as always. The few people he'd considered friends had either betrayed him or distanced themselves from what everyone saw as a broken force. Being too close to the king was the kiss of death these days, in politics or society. That left just the clones and the aliens. The clones were tied to Finn, and the aliens had troubles of their own. the king, had been isolated. Douglas was also very concerned that he still hadn't been able to get any news about his father. House Campbell was strictly off limits to everyone, very definitely including him. Finn kept promising the media the full story of William's treachery, but he was in no hurry. No one had seen the inside of House Campbell since Finn's raid. The continuing silence worried Douglas almost to distraction, but he didn't let anyone see it. He just worked doggedly on his plan to break into House Campbell, rescue his father, and get him somewhere safe. If he could just hold himself together long enough, and if his father were still alive.
I would like to call His Majesty's attention to another matter.
Douglas suddenly realized that Meera Puri was speaking to him directly from the floor of the house, trying to get him involved in the debate. Douglas deliberately slumped down a little further in his throne and just nodded vaguely to her. Meera Puri was one of the few politicians left in the house that he still approved of, and he had no doubt she meant well. But Douglas had to play his role of the beaten man in public. He needed Finn and his people to believe that he was beaten, that the king was no threat to them or their plans, so that they wouldn't see him coming until it was too late. But Meera Puri persisted in addressing him, so he reluctantly sat up and paid attention.
Your Majesty, it is the express will of this house and of the people that the king needs a queen. The people need a king and a queen. So the honorable members of this house have, after lengthy discussions, finally made a decision as to who should be your new wife and queen.
Douglas gave her a hard look. He couldn't believe they'd slipped this one past him.
This is the first I've heard of this.
Yes, but you were incommunicado for some time, Your Majesty.
So I was. Well, I see the necessity, I suppose. Who have you chosen this time?
James came striding onto the floor of the house. On his arm, a very beautiful and entirely voluptuous woman, dressed in the very height of revealing fashion. She was extremely blonde, utterly devastating, and if she'd been any more curvaceous, there would have been two of her. Douglas recognized her immediately. Treasure McKenzie, lead actress and star of the Empire's most popular vid soap, The Quality.
So, they've gone for beauty without brains this time. Probably just as well, really.
Treasure and James came to a halt before the throne, and Douglas came down to greet them. Treasure curtsied very low in a graceful rustle of silks, showing off more cleavage in one place than Douglas had seen in his life. James actually blushed and looked away, and couldn't let go of her arm fast enough. Douglas bowed to Treasure and reached out to take her tiny hand in his.
Please rise, my dear. That's better. You look delightful. This is your will to be my queen. You understand the responsibilities you will be taking on.
Oh, yes, Your Majesty. I couldn't be happier about this. Are you happy about this, Douglas?
He smiled at her. He couldn't say no in front of everyone. It would have been like disappointing a child.
A king must marry. I've always known that. And you seem to me a perfect choice.
And I am to be the best man.
Of course, you always are, James.
Douglas looked across at Meera Puri.
Set a date for the royal wedding.
Treasure beamed and dimpled becomingly. Douglas smiled and nodded and considered his position. He couldn't say no to a royal wedding. The people needed it too badly. They wanted to put the bad business of Louis and Jessamine behind them, and they needed something good to look forward to take their minds off the coming terror and the Paragon's continuing failure to find Owen. Treasure seemed a safe enough choice. Typical actress bimbo, mouthful of teeth and a bra full of talent, too dim to make political trouble. It would be a marriage in name only, but he was sure she knew that. He'd already given his heart to another, and nothing had happened to change that. Afterwards, Treasure McKenzie looked in her mirror and smiled her true smile. It had all gone much better than she'd expected. But then, only a very few people present had known that she was also Frankie, dark mistress of the Hellfire Club. She couldn't wait to be queen.
Huh?
On the bridge of the hijacked yacht Hereward, Brett Random and Rose Constantine were doing their best to kill each other again. They stamped back and forth in the confined space, slamming their swords together with vicious strength, each trying to catch the other off guard. They circled slowly, breathing heavily, their eyes intent and focused, their faces wet with the sweat of their exertions. Rose was grinning, Brett was cold and grim. They sprang at each other again, cutting and blocking and re-engaging almost too quickly to be followed. Rose had been the undoubted champion of the Logris Arena, never defeated in any of her many matches. But Brett was holding his own, and more. They'd been dueling non-stop for almost 40 minutes now, and neither had managed even to touch the other, which was a whole new record. Rose had determined to teach Brett how to fight after witnessing his miserable performance against the attack troops on Unseelie. Brett knew how to defend himself. He couldn't grow up in the rookery without acquiring a working knowledge of most weapons, but he was no fighter and would be the first to admit it. Too soft-hearted, he would have said, with a smile and a shrug. Brett firmly believed that there wasn't a problem in the world or off it that couldn't be best solved by running away from it. He also believed in letting other people do the fighting whenever possible, while he hung innocently around the edges, keeping an eye out for any tasty items that were just asking to be picked up and pocketed by a nimble-fingered fellow. Brett was a thief, a con man, and a devout coward, and he figured that was enough professions for any one man. But Rose was having none of that. She still wasn't sure how she felt about Brett, but she definitely didn't want him getting himself killed before she made up her mind. So she took it upon herself to teach Brett everything she knew about how to handle a sword, and she knew a hell of a lot. Brett, not for the first time, didn't get a say in the matter. So the two of them spent most of their trip to the old leper planet of Lacrimi Christi, dueling ferociously on the Hereward's bridge. Brett picked it up extremely quickly, not least because Rose was quite willing to cut him a good one if he didn't pay attention. And it wasn't long before the two of them were almost equally matched. No one else could have mastered Rose's many skills so quickly. But the telepathic bond forged between Brett and Rose when he first took the damned Esper drug was still operating, on deep, dark, and unexpected levels. Rose had to show him something only once, and it was as though he'd always known it. The sword seemed alive in his hand, responsive as a lover. And the more he learned, the more easily it all came. All he needed now was practice to hone his reflexes and build muscle tone. And Rose sharpened his skills in the only way she knew how, by doing her level best to kill him every time they dueled. Brett did his best to kill her too. It was only polite. And so they stamped and lunged and parried, putting everything they had into every blow, dueling on long after anyone else would have had to stop. But finally, the timer they'd set in the bridge's comm panels went off, and they disengaged and stepped cautiously back from each other. They slowly lowered their swords. They'd learned the hard way that they had to have a timer, because sometimes the intensity of their dueling took them to another place, where nothing mattered but the clash of steel on steel and the search for heart's blood, where they would have dueled each other to exhaustion before either would give up. They put away their swords and nodded respectfully to each other. Brett produced a handkerchief with someone else's monogram on it and wiped his face. Rose looked at him almost fondly.
You make a good pupil, Brett. There's not much left I can teach you, but you'll never be able to beat me. Not until you develop the killer's instinct.
I'll never beat you because you're a homicidal bloody psychopath.
It's a gift. I can't take any credit for it.
They stared at each other for a while, and then Rose moved slowly over to stand before Brett. She studied his face intently.
This is all new to me, Brett. I never had a pupil before, never had a partner, or a friend.
She considered the matter thoughtfully. Brett stood very still. Rose was never more dangerous than when she was thinking. Besides, he didn't understand their relationship either, and he was curious to hear what she would come up with.
I never needed anyone else in my life. Never wanted anyone except to kill. As long as I had the arena and the blood and the suffering, I was content. Murder was sex. The killing stroked my orgasm, and I was happy. Then our minds touched. And in that moment, I saw things. Emotions, feelings, possibilities I'd never considered before. Sex was different for you. A joining, sharing thing. It was so much more. I want to feel those things, even if I'm not sure why. I like teaching you. I like seeing you become more like me. But there are things only you can teach me.
Oh, yeah?
She moved another step closer. Brett stood his ground. It was like having a wild animal come out of the jungle and walk right up to you to stare curiously into your eyes. He could feel beads of sweat forming on his forehead again. Their mouths were so close now, they could feel each other's breath on their lips. Rose was frowning slightly, as though considering a difficult problem. And then, she took him gently into her murderous arms. In the cargo bay of the Hereward, in a rough nest he'd made from boxes of the alien porn data crystals, the Reptiloid Saturday was fast asleep. He'd been sleeping ever since they left on Seelie, his emerald green belly swollen and distended from all the people he'd eaten. He smiled toothily in his sleep, and occasionally his tail or his clawed hands would twitch as he dreamed happy dreams of slaughter and feeding. None of the others had any intention of waking him until they absolutely had to. And then they'd do it from a safe distance, probably using something long to poke him with. While Brett and Rose grew closer and the Reptiloid slept, Louis Deathstalker and Jessamine Flowers caught up on their quality time. To be exact, they'd taken over the main cabin, locked the door securely, and hadn't left the bed for 2 days, except for certain necessary trips to the food synthesizer or the bathroom. They were currently standing together at the foot of the bed, both entirely naked, looking at themselves in the full-length mirror on the wall. Jessamine was frowning. She studied her famous face and figure with critical, merciless eyes, turning this way and that to check all the angles and find her best side. Louis stood easily beside her, one arm draped companionably around her slim waist. When he looked at them both together in the mirror, he saw Beauty and the Beast, and wondered, not for the first time, what someone so breathtakingly beautiful saw in an ugly brute like him.
Oh, God, I look awful.
What are you talking about? You look wonderful. You always look wonderful. If you were any more perfect, you'd be banned as harmful to the eyes.
I've got a roll of fat around my belly, my tits are sagging, and I'm actually afraid to turn around and look at my bum. I can feel it heading towards the floor as we speak. This is what having to live without full-time beauty technicians does to a woman. I'm not as young as I was, you know. Once a woman reaches a certain age, she has to spend a lot of time taking care of herself, or it all falls apart in the middle of the night and she wakes up looking like her mother. It's a fact!
You look fine to me. You look great. I wouldn't change an inch.
Aww. You say the sweetest things, darling man.
Jessamine kissed him absently on the cheek, and then went back to studying herself in the mirror. Louis sighed, but had enough sense to do it internally. Even with his limited experience with women, he knew they were venturing onto dangerous ground here. Women never saw themselves as they really were. Inside, they were always judging themselves against some imaginary perfect image they picked up in their youth and never broke free from. Jessamine Flowers was famous as one of the most gorgeous women in an empire full of beautiful women, and here she was, scowling at her reflection as though she'd just acquired jowls and a mustache. Louis looked at himself and had no illusions. He was built for stamina, not speed, and his muscles were made for action, not posing. He let the fingertips of one hand trail unhurriedly across the various new scars he'd acquired since leaving Logris. There were quite a few of them, from swords and guns and explosions, places where death had touched him briefly in passing. Scars were a new thing for Louis. As a paragon on Logris, he'd had automatic access to regeneration machines, so that even the worst wounds never left a permanent mark on him. The Hereward had no regen tank. He had to heal naturally, and he hated it. It was slow and uncomfortable, it interrupted his thinking, and it left scars, as if he wasn't ugly enough already. Jessamine put a gentle hand over his as it traced a long scar down his left side.
You got that one fighting to protect me in Traitor's Hall in the Bloody Tower. I remember. You've been through so much pain for my sake.
You're worth it. I was never really happy, never really alive till I met you.
Jessamine put an arm around his waist.
You always know the right things to say, my dear. But when this is all over, you're going straight into a regeneration tank and we're getting rid of those awful scars.
They serve a purpose. These scars are reminders to be more careful, more thoughtful about everything I do. Because I can be killed so easily out here, and so can you. Oh, if you were killed, I wouldn't want to go on living without you.
She kissed him to stop him saying such things, and afterwards Jessamine looked at Lewis's face for a long time, tracing its harsh lines with a gentle fingertip.
You have a face like a force of nature, Lewis. Hard, unyielding, but not unattractive. You could have altered it, become anonymously handsome like everyone else. Why did you never change it?
Because then I wouldn't have looked like me anymore. It would have been like wearing a mask. Wearing a lie. With me, what you see is pretty much what you get. I never changed my appearance for the same reason Anne never changed hers, because we're proud of who we are.
They both turned away from the mirror at the same time and sat down together on the end of the bed. There were things they needed to talk about, things they'd been putting off, but the time had come. They could feel it.
We can't go to Hayden. We're not ready, Jess. Not yet.
Yes.
Have you ever been to Lacrimae Christi before?
God, no, darling. Can't think of many who have by choice. It may not be a leper colony anymore, but it's still a desolate bloody place by all accounts, at the arse end of civilization, with no comforts to speak of and not a single theatre worth playing. Whole planet is one big jungle. It's always raining, and they probably eat tourists on sight.
We have to go there, Jess.
I know.
Tobias Moon is still there. Still alive, supposedly. The only remaining survivor of the Madness Maze, from the age of the Great Rebellion. Owen's companion and his friend. If he's still alive, and if he'll talk to us, Moon could tell us things that no one else could.
Not the only Maze survivor. Samuel Chevron turned out to be really John Silence, remember?
Was he? He claimed to be Chevron to us and Silence to Carrion. But he also claimed to be dead. So I think I'll take everything he said with several grains of salt. Until I have some way of confirming he is who he says he is.
Carrion recognized him as Silence?
Carrion has been living as an Ashrai for 2 centuries. After that long, probably all humans look the same to him.
But he might be John Silence. And he said we should go straight to Hayden. He wanted us to go into the Madness Maze. I don't think I could do that, Lewis. Not ever. It might kill us, or make us something other than human. And I don't know which scares me more.
I think we're all scared of the maze, Jess.
Lewis kissed her bare shoulder reassuringly.
All the more reason to acquire as much dependable information as we can before we even think about going anywhere near Hayden. Besides, Hayden is the one place Finn will be sure to think we're going to. You can bet good money he's arranged a really nasty surprise for us there. No. First Tobias Moon, and then we'll think about Hayden and the maze.
He could be dead. No one's seen Moon for years.
He was a Hayden man before he went into the maze. God knows what he was afterwards.
I don't think God has anything to do with the maze.
Sometime later, fully dressed and properly turned out, they went back to the bridge. Rose was sitting cross-legged on the floor in one corner, polishing her sword blade with long, easy strokes of the cloth. She didn't look up at their entrance. Brett was sitting slumped in the pilot's chair, scowling at nothing. He jumped up immediately when Lewis came in and slouched over to lean against the far wall.
Lewis hid a smile. He knew what was wrong with Brett Random. The con man had emptied the medicine cabinet of every drug worth taking, and never being one to plan ahead where his pleasures were concerned, had used them all up. Brett had spent the last several days entirely sober, loudly declaring it to be an unnatural state and that he hated it. Even alien porn had lost its thrill. Although he would never have admitted it, Brett was actually grateful to Rose for insisting on dueling lessons. They stopped him going crazy from boredom. He shot Lewis and Jessamine a sulky glare for being so cheerful.
Well, look who's finally emerged from the cabin of joy. I take it the bedroom gymnastics are over for now? Ooh, I don't suppose you took any video for the collection.
Oz, talk to me. How much further to Lacrimae Christi?
We're there. We dropped out of hyperspace and moved into high orbit just over 4 hours ago. No one else could have got you here this quickly. I'm just a navigating fool. Grease my circuits and call me Speedy. You don't appreciate me, you know.
We're here? Why didn't you tell me?
Because you were otherwise engaged. And very noisily, too. Far be it from me to interrupt. If you're ready to get involved in the mission again, I'll bring you up to date on everything that's been happening.
Don't you get snotty with me. You're just a porn smuggler ship's AI with a quick personality overlay.
I'm also the only one around here who can work out hyperspace re-entry coordinates, so keep a civil tongue in your head. I don't know what it is about Death Stalkers, but they're always really crabby first thing in the morning. I blame it on bad potty training. Now then, I've run a full scan to the limits of my senses, and there's no sign of Imperial ships lurking anywhere in the vicinity.
Well, that's odd. You'd have thought that Durr and Jor would have sent at least one Star Cruiser to stop us making contact with Tobias Moon.
It's not odd at all, as you'd know if you'd done your homework on Lacrimae Christi. I did provide you all with complete files on the planet. Lacrimae Christi is one big rain-soaked jungle, full of vicious, aggressive, and semi-sentient plants of such a predatory nature that animal life never got a hook in here. All of these plants have a mass consciousness called the Red Brain, and Big Red is apparently very picky over who gets to orbit his world. Really bad things have been known to happen to ships that don't pay attention to his warnings. The only ships allowed to land at the only starport are trading ships, strictly by appointment only. However, I have contacted one Natasha Wells at the starport, and she's willing to talk to a Death Stalker. Shall I put her on?
Might as well.
You don't appreciate me. You really don't.
Hello there, uninvited ship. Don't start kicking your equipment. We've lost picture again. It's going to be one of those days, I can tell. And me with one of my headaches. This is Natasha Wells hailing you from the St. Beatrice Memorial Starport, letting you know that you are not at all welcome. Gah! Unless you're carrying comm unit spares. Or chocolate. You aren't, are you? I thought not. If it was up to me, I'd tell you all to go to hell by the express route. But Tobias Moon vouches for you, and I don't get any say in the matter.
At least now we know Moon is still alive.
What was that? Speak up! I hate muttering. So you're Lewis Deathstalker and companions on the Hair Ward. You wouldn't believe what your ship was carrying the last time it tried to dock here. Anyway, you're late. We've been expecting you for days. Moon assured us you were coming a week ago, and that man is never wrong, which is actually kind of creepy when you think about it. So let's agree not to. Now then, I have to check my list. According to Moon, Sir Deathstalker, you should have with you... one diva, one confidence trickster, one homicidal psychopath, and a reptiloid, whatever the hell that is. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Trust me, I'm no happier about it than you are.
If it was up to me, I'd shoot the lot of you down right now, just because. But no one ever listens to me. No good will come of this. My computers are sending you landing coordinates. Now, don't get it wrong. We're the only starport on the planet with strictly limited space on the landing pads, by choice. We don't encourage visitors. Hell, we do everything but throw rocks at them and insult their mothers, and they still keep coming. So land where you're told, and then follow directions to the nearest city. It's a bit of a walk, but you can probably use the exercise. You'll be met at Mission City, which is absolutely stuffed full of fascinating history about this planet, if you care for that sort of thing. Be sure to buy some souvenirs, as they're cluttering up the place. Talk to Helen Adair and she'll get you to Tobias Moon. And behave yourselves! The Deathstalker name buys you a certain amount of leeway, and Moon's usually a pretty good judge of character for an ex-Hayden man. But even so...
We're not welcome. I think we get the point.
Tourists are like hemorrhoids. They hang around, they turn red, and they're a pain in the arse. Land and be damned and see if I care. And don't contact me again. I have some serious napping to be getting on with.
She reminds me of my mum.
The Hereward touched down uneventfully at the St. Beatrice Memorial Starport. It was the only ship on the landing pads. Lewis led the way out, after instructing Ozymandias to run full security measures at all times, but not to shoot anyone unless he felt he absolutely had to. The group gathered outside the airlock and blinked about them in the gray light from the overcast sky. The landing pads were barely half a mile in diameter, surrounded on all sides by the savage crimson jungle. Not all that surprising, there was no one there to greet them. No control tower, no customs post, no signs of human civilization at all.
This is what you woke me up for? It's cold, it's wet, and the trees are the wrong color. I suppose you're going to tell me next that I'm not allowed to kill anyone here.
Not without asking first. We want to make a good impression here.
Then we should leave Brett in the ship.
Fine by me. I don't mind, really.
Shut up, Brett.
Lewis checked the directions he'd been given against his internal compass.
Mission City should be... that way. 2.5 miles as the crow flies.
We have to walk. Isn't there any transport laid on for visitors in expensive shoes?
There aren't any roads here. According to what I read in the files, civilization is an occasional thing on Lacrimae Christi. The trip shouldn't be too bad. The jungle's a lot tamer now than it was in Owen's day. Come on, people. The sooner we get started, the sooner we'll be there.
As the group set out across the landing pads, Brett turned to Rose.
Don't you just hate people who say cheerful things like that?
Rose nodded solemnly. They headed for the waiting tree line. The jungle was cold and dark, surrounded by an overwhelming menace. Jessamine pressed in close beside Lewis.
I've got a really bad feeling about this, Lewis. No one to meet us, no escort. Anything could be waiting for us in that jungle. How do we know Finn didn't get here first, make a deal with the natives, and set a trap for us?
Oz would have detected something. That porn smuggler ship has state-of-the-art sensors and then some. I wouldn't have landed here unless I was reasonably sure we got here first. Don't worry, Jess. I promised you that I would stand between you and all harm. Come with me.
Jessamine smiled, despite herself.
My hero. All right. Next worrying question. Why does Mission City have to be so far from the starport? Apart from the fact that they clearly don't care for visitors.
They don't want Empire Tech too close to them. The people here regard Tech as a necessary evil, and they do without it as much as they can. My guess is they're still harboring resentments over their ancestors being just dumped here and abandoned. Didn't you read any of the files I put aside for you?
I got sidetracked, remember?
Lewis looked away, more than slightly embarrassed.
God, darling, you blush really easily for a Deathstalker.
Lewis led the way into the Scarlet Jungle. The towering trees had thick black boles and heavy crimson leaves with sharp serrated edges. All around the jutting foliage and sudden bursts of undergrowth were every shade of red in fierce organic hues, as though they had walked inside a living body. Bright pink streamers of crawling vines and matted ivy curled around the black tree trunks, moving slowly, constantly, like dreaming snakes. Blood-red lianas and hanging vines twisted and swung slowly, though there wasn't a breath of a breeze on the still air. Even the ground was covered with pulsing scarlet mosses and mulch. And everywhere, every part of the jungle was moving, seething, twisting, and stirring, awake and aware, and slowly aggressive. For millions of years, there was nothing but plant life on Lacrimae Christi, until the Empire came and made it a colony. A leper colony, to be exact. There was no cure and no hope for them, so the sufferers were just rounded up and dumped there, and no one gave a damn if they survived or not. For a long time, there was war between the leper colonists and the unrelenting jungle, until Tobias Moon came and made telepathic contact with the mass consciousness of the plant life, the Red Brain, and brokered a symbiotic peace. At least, that was the legend. Lewis didn't have the faith in legends that he once had. But the peace applied only in and around the cities. In the wild, the plants were just as hungry and vicious as they'd ever been. Some of the larger plants were already lurching eagerly towards the intruders, with lunch on their mind. Lewis shot several of them, and Rose tore several more to shreds. Brett kicked hell out of a shrub, just to be doing his bit.
Take that, you dirty, slimy little bugger!
Several small fires broke out, quickly smothered by surrounding plants. After that, the bigger plants pretty much ignored the party, as long as they didn't get too close. Lewis drew his sword and set about the slow process of cutting a trail through the uncooperative mass of vegetation before him. It was hard work and slow going. His sword jarred painfully against the heavier branches, and vines clung stickily to his blade until he jerked it free. He pressed on, his arm rising and falling mechanically, while sweat dripped from his face. The others stuck close, while the jungle slowly closed the trail behind them. The air was thick and heavy with so many scents, it was like an overwhelming perfume that raised strange atavistic feelings. It was as though the members of the party belonged in the jungle, and always had. Like coming home. There was more oxygen in the air than they were used to, and it left them all feeling heady and a little giddy. The rain slowed to a steady pitter-patter. The overhead canopy of interlocking tree branches was much thicker than it had been, this close to the human settlements, due to the intervention of the Red Brain. But even so, Lewis and his companions were soon soaked through, as much from sweat as rain, as they plowed through the humid air of the uncooperative jungle. Only the reptiloid Saturday wasn't physically discomforted, the rain running easily off his scaly hide. Of them all, he should have been the most at home, but the semi-sentient jungle disturbed him greatly, and his great wedge head swung constantly back and forth, alert for any attack. On his world, the plants were the only things that didn't try to kill you. Experimentally, he grabbed one of the plants. Evolution had not designed Saturday to be a vegetarian. Rose didn't approve of the jungle at all. Rose was a city person, born and bred, and had no use at all for the great outdoors. She liked roads and transport and climate control, and all the other niceties of the human condition.
Weather is what poor people have.
Also, killing plants did nothing for her. It seemed somehow beneath her. Brett was miserable, but then he always was. At least no one was shooting at him here. Yet. Lewis logged along at the front of the group, opening a path through the stubborn jungle with his sword, and occasionally the razor-sharp edges of his force shield. It was slow, hard work, and even his hardened muscles grew weary in time. After one particularly long break for Lewis to get his breath back, Saturday volunteered to take over. He slammed through the crimson vegetation, using his size and bulk and weight to force open a trail. But all too soon became tangled and trapped in a seething mass of creepers and vines, and had to be cut free. The reptiloid returned to the back of the group for some serious sulking. Rose took over cutting trail, and chopped and hacked her way through the jungle like a machine from hell. But even she grew tired eventually. She wouldn't admit it, of course, and in the end, Brett had to drag her almost bodily to a halt to rest. He patted her comfortingly on her leather-clad shoulder, at arm's length, her cold glare daring anyone to say anything.
I've got a better idea. Watch this.
Brett scowled, concentrating on the slowly stirring vegetation before him, and then hit it with a focused blast of his Esp compulsion. The scarlet and pink foliage shook and shuddered under the impact of his mind, and then slowly retreated back out of the way, so that a narrow trail opened up before the group, as if by magic. Brett did a little celebratory dance. But his sense of triumph was short-lived. Something reached out of the dark, secret heart of the jungle and touched his exposed mind. Brett froze where he was, as a vast alien presence slowly turned its attention upon him. It was like a huge eye, studying him coldly. And he was so very, very small. Fred hadn't been so scared since he'd glimpsed the Esper Oversoul back on Logris. This was worse. At least the Oversoul had a human nature. The red brain was different, utterly inhuman. It was just too big, too much for him to bear, and he slammed down all his mental shields, concealing his thoughts and his presence behind as many layers of barriers as he could fashion. Only a few seconds had passed. No one else had noticed anything. Lewis was still studying the newly opened trail. Rose was looking at Brett thoughtfully, but that was nothing new.
All right, Brett. I am officially impressed. How the hell did you do that?
Brett looked at the trail ahead. It was still holding its shape, even though he wasn't holding it open anymore. Presumably, the red brain had decided to let things stand. He realized Lewis was waiting for an answer.
It's part of the Esper game from taking Finn's damn Esper drug. I can make things obey me.
Things, not people?
Oh, no! Heaven forbid, Sir Deathstalker. What do you think I am, some kind of elf? I do have principles, you know. Not as many as other people, perhaps, but...
Lewis gave him a hard look, and then turned away and set off along the new trail. It kept opening up before them, and the going became much easier. But still the ground was uneven and treacherous, and the trail swerved and weaved around the huge dark-boled trees. They slogged on, and time passed slowly. And still there was no sign of Mission City. No one was talking to anyone anymore because it always led to arguments, and they didn't have the energy. Jessamine could feel the others shooting her the occasional speculative glance, clearly waiting for her to start whining again about being a star and how she shouldn't have to put up with conditions like this. So she gritted her teeth and toughed it out, keeping grimly silent just despite them. Her back ached, her legs were trembling from the strain, her shoes were ruined, but she was damned if she'd give the others the satisfaction of hearing her complain, even Lewis, who would of course be very understanding. Jessamine was getting tougher, and she was stronger than she'd thought. She took pride in keeping up the pace with the rest of them, and started to remember how proudly self-reliant she'd always been when she was younger, and just starting out on her career, when she'd had to fight her way on and off stage, and face down sleazy managers afterwards to get the wages owed her. It occurred to Jessamine that she preferred this new tough her to the old pampered her, though she was damned if she'd admit that to anyone, even Lewis. For all their struggle through the Crimson Jungle, the group couldn't help but be impressed by it. The jungle was just so big and old and overpoweringly alien. With the gloom of the overhead canopy and the sudden shafts of murky light breaking through like spotlights in the blood-red ambience, it was like walking through some vast, living cathedral. Lewis found the words of the AIs of Shub running through his mind like a mantra. All that lives is holy. Everywhere he looked, he saw miracles of evolution, sophisticated refinements of shape and purpose that had no place in the world of ordinary plants. Everything was moving, driven on by slow intent. Some of the larger growths lurched back and forth under their own volition, on unguessable errands for unknowable reasons. Here and there, lush flowers had developed mouths and chittered softly in languages beyond human understanding, unless they were the kind of words people heard softly spoken in dreams and could never remember on waking. Some flowers had learned to sing in strange and subtle harmonies, and this was sometimes horrid and sometimes pleasant, but mostly disturbing. Finally, they came to Mission City. The jungle fell suddenly away, as if they'd stepped out of one room and into another, and the city lay sprawled out before them in its massive clearing. Lewis and his companions just stood there in the rain for a while at the edge of the jungle, taking in the city they had traveled so long and so hard to reach. Mission City was no human construction, no dead thing of steel and glass and concrete. This was a Lacrimae Christi city, a vast bioengineered entity, grown, not made, designed by the minds of men, but manufactured to order from the raw materials of the Scarlet Jungle by the guiding intelligence of the Red Brain. It was a living thing, holding humans within, like a mother cradling her children in her caring arms. Huge hollowed trees, vast as skyscrapers, soared up into the overcast sky, their interiors a wooden honeycomb of living space. Warm organic lights glowed from the hundreds of windows in the dark bark of the towering trees. Delicate corridors of woven vines connected all levels, hanging between the trees like so much crimson webbing, the connective tissues of a living city. Lower dwellings had been formed from hulking gourds or vast hollowed fruits or leafy constructs in blazing shades of pink. And everywhere there were flowers and great rose petal constructs and tremendous organic shapes blazing with warm, friendly lights. It was a city, and it was alive. They could feel the warmth of it and hear its breathing. And men and women went about their lives in it as though it was the most natural thing in the world.
Deathstalker Return is continued on the next CD.